Everyone's asleep.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated island-chained paradise in the sunny slave South Pacific, with that Fukushima radiation that's so disastrously fabulous that it's helped the economy, along with giving everybody a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. And my very special guest is none other than Ian Packman from stonesofakron.com. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Vinnie.
Would you mind giving us a little bit of a divulgence? Let us know who you are and what it is you do.
Fair enough. I was born in England. I'm a POM, I suppose. But I got fed up with the Maggie Thatcher era of the 1970s and 80s and the IRA and the crap that was going on there. And I used to be in the Merchant Navy as an engineer. So I used to be coming to New Zealand on a number of occasions and coming to the other side of the world. I just thought what a completely different environment New Zealand was compared to what was happening in England. So after about 10 years, I decided I'd emigrate over here, and with the engineering background, I got a job at New Plymouth Power Station here, a big thermal power station. And started work there, but then engineering was never my. It wasn't something I always wanted to do. It was something I fell into because it was a way of getting a job and getting started in life. But I always wanted to write. I was always a great reader of books and researcher. And so a few years ago, I said to my wife, "I would like to write a book." And the problem was that being at sea at the time, you get very tired, and you just simply can't write and do the job at sea. So it was a question of, do I write and leave the sea, or do I stay at sea and never follow the dream of writing? So she read a bit of the works that I had done, and she said, give up the sea and start writing. So from sort of 2004 up to 2009, I wrote a trilogy called Stones of Akron, a sci-fi fantasy trilogy for all ages. And then we had a problem with getting it published. We tried several publishing houses, but it's basically impossible. So we decided to self-publish, and we approached a guy here in Plymouth, and they said, yep, not a problem. And within a few months, we had the books published, and then we started hitting the road and selling them. And they proved to be very successful, I'm very thankful to say. The public, after a few months, there was a bit of a downtime there while they were reading. The emails coming back and the phone calls was that they thoroughly enjoyed them. So I actually completed the trilogy and the publishing of it, because we only published book one to begin with. We'll see how it goes. And then the feedback was, where on earth is book two? We want it now. So we had to work extremely hard and fast to get book two ready. And then, of course, book three was a foregone conclusion. The story is across three books. It isn't three separate books. It's one story across three books. So it was cunning plan.
Ian, you might want to sit a little closer to your microphone there. You're kind of a bit distant.
Okay.
Yeah, that's a heck of a lot better there. Right. Well, so what's involved in writing a trilogy? I mean, have you had any challenges to your personal constitution or something in the process of this?
It's a huge challenge to the brain. A trilogy is a big book to write, especially I wrote it with time travel involved, and I had well over 100 characters in the books. The main characters, there are two groups of teenagers and a few adults scattered around. So the big problem for me was just actually keeping track of it all and keeping track of the story I was writing, especially with the time travel, because it book two just about defeated me, because I'd written myself into a corner where I'd had people scattered all over the universe at different times in the future, in the past, the present, and I had to bring them all back together, and that really proved a major problem, because I was stuck with it. So my wife and I actually went up to Turangi for a weekend, and we just brainstormed the whole thing to try and figure it out, and we did, and came back and sorted it all out. So it was a lot of mental work. There were several years involved in writing the three books. But it worked. So you know, the satisfaction was that what was just a fantasy in my head actually turned out to be a pretty good story, which people have really, really enjoyed.
Yeah. Have you ever found the problem with fiction is that you have to make it make sense?
That is a major thing, especially with science fiction. You're dealing with facts. You're dealing with time travel as we know it on a scientific level. So you have to be very careful about what you do. You can't put it into the realms of just pure stupidity. It has to be acceptable. And the public at large, especially the scientific science fiction public, they're pretty intelligent people, and they, you know, they've studied Star Trek and all the rest of the sci-fi and television stuff and the books, the Isaac Asimov and all the rest of it. So they're pretty discerning, and if you start bullshitting them, they'll just switch off. So it was important for me to think very carefully about what I was doing. If I introduced anything, I had to think very careful. Is this practicable? Is it understandable? Will it be accepted? And every time I approached something like that, that was very much on the back of my mind. I was very aware that there are going to be critics out there, and they're going to tear it to pieces. So I got my endorsement from a gentleman here in New Plymouth who was an astrologer, and he read the book, and read the first book, and then was demanding book two and book three. And he said, no, you've got everything correct. He couldn't find any fault in it. And so from having that endorsement from somebody that knows space and stars and moons and all the rest of it, that was pretty pleasing. I was pretty worried about that.
I watched this film called North Country, and in the making of it, one of the producers said, what a film's synopsis is really supposed to be like is, first of all, what's the film about? Second of all, what it's really about, and third of all, what it's really, really about.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty in-depth answer.
Well, I'd like to hear the in-depth answer from you. So, you know, I don't know if that's even possible. I mean, you know, don't want to put you on the spot here, but
it is. I did, when I was travelling around the country talking to people at craft fairs and things, and they were asking me, you know, what's the book about? And, of course, the first answer is that it's an adventure story, basically, sci-fi, fantasy, based on factual places. So there is the basic beginnings of the book. It's just basically an adventure story. But it's also a book that teaches young people. I'm very much sort of old school in terms of a book should be there for entertainment and education. And there are different levels of education, of course. So that there is that side of the book. So I was anticipating young people reading it, and I was teaching them, as I was telling them the story, I was teaching them about people, societies, and the weather, geology, mountains, space travel, all sorts of things, mystery, magic. And then, of course, there is another level to it, which is, it touches, for the older readers, it touches on the political in terms of the madness that we have in our world, and really the madness of the human being, really. It's too easy to say the madness that we have in the world today. It's really focusing on the stupidity of people that we have in our society. And then there's another level on top of that, which is, it all depends on who you are and what you want to see in the book, but there is a spiritual level in the book, and that is one that is very much focused on the individual. I don't talk about it as such. What I do is I use the subject as part of the story. So it's up to the individual to see it. And there's no point in ramming it down a 12-year-old. You have to take into account the wisdom and maturity of the reader. So the books do have a multi-level understanding. And that, I was wondering when I wrote it whether or not it would work, and it did to an amazing degree, because after 3 years of selling and all the feedback that we've got, I had an email from a lady who told me that her 10-year-old son had read books 1 and 2, and at the end of book 2 said to his mother that he thought his world had come to an end. And the problem then was that I was still desperately trying to get book 3 published. And my oldest reader was a gentleman in Napier that I met at a craft show. He was 91 years old. He was an ex-Spitfire pilot from the Second World War. And he bought the first 2 books, as though book 3 wasn't published. And he read both books in 2 weeks. And then he emailed me and said he thoroughly enjoyed them and couldn't wait for book 3. So to write a trilogy, basically, where you can say you've got a reading age group from 10 to 90, male and female, I would say that I've actually succeeded in the different levels that I introduced in the book. So the 10-year-old would see the level that he sees, and the 90-year-old would see all of the levels, because with the wealth of experience and wisdom that man had, it was quite heartwarming to have his comments, and he enjoyed the books. Over to you.
Over to me, of course, indeed. The other element here is, as well, if you're trying to, I think when I wrote a play and put it on, I think the measure of what I wanted to get across was a physical reaction out of the audience. Like, I wanted to make them cry.
Right.
And I did.
Right.
And I thought that that's basically part of the most powerful thing that you can do with a work of fiction, is to produce a real reaction.
Yes, yes. And that's what I was looking for in the readers, because every time I sold a book to the customer, I would demand from them that they get in touch with me and email me or phone me or whatever, and just give me their appreciation of the story, good or bad. And a lot of them did. And I was quite overwhelmed at the response that I got. And, of course, I was looking for particular answers to questions. And from one lady in particular, I knew from her character, I knew that there would be a chapter in book 1 that would affect her. And I knew it did, because she never mentioned it. And it was a very powerful scene, and it would bring tears to your eyes. She talked about everything else, but she wouldn't talk about that chapter. So it was there, and I had other comments later on from people about certain chapters, about the humour in it. So I was very pleased. It's actually quite difficult, I found, to get the humour, because people's ability to laugh at things is incredibly varied. And that reflects in the soap operas and the dramas and the comedians that we have today. So I was quite pleased that some people actually said they liked the humour in the book, and you get those that would be in tears. And the very last book, the third book, and there is a sad bit at the end, but I sort of interspersed it with some happiness. And one lady, I sent the book to her as soon as it was off the press, and she read it in a few days and emailed me, and she said her words were, it was a shame that we had to lose some of the characters and some of the people, but she understood, and she then mentioned one scene right at the end of the book, and she said if it was ever made into a film, there wouldn't be a dry eye in the auditorium. So that was deliberately done, and it worked with her, so clearly the success of it is in the response. And it is a very satisfying thing, as you will have found, if you write a play and you will get a direct answer straight away from the reaction of your audience in the play. But when you write a book, it's actually quite hard to get that feedback from people. Sometimes you actually have to dig it out of them.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's because they're not there, and I think maybe reading a book is more of a private thing, you know, like you can't be talking and having a conversation with somebody while you're reading.
No, and when you read a book, you go off into your own dream world with a book, because you become absorbed in the story, and this is what happens, you know, people pick up a book and they start reading it, and when they enjoy it, you know, they're off in fairyland, they're off living the scene and the characters and everything else, and very much the Charles Dickens or Around the World in 80 Days and Jules Verne and all that. You actually live the experiences. So it is hard. These people, this is why one of the things that I found when writing and having characters in a book, it's a mistake to over-describe characters, because it doesn't matter how much description you give. The reader will implant in their own conscience how that person speaks, how they look, you know, what colour their hair is and all this. And I found that out with one of the characters. I didn't specifically say certain things about the character, but I implied it. And when I asked people months later, every one of the descriptions of this girl was different. So it's a waste of time actually describing people in a book too much, because people will create their own character in their own mind.
Well, isn't that interesting? Maybe that's like part of why soap operas are so successful, is because people see themselves in the characters.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I had a discussion with somebody just recently, because if you go onto the UK channel on Sky, number 13, where they show all of these old English comedy program things, but they also show Dallas. Now, Dallas came on at a time in my life when I was away at sea for a great length of time, and I would be coming back from sea, and everybody you meet was talking about Dallas and the character, and I couldn't understand this overwhelming belief in the characters of these people. And I never saw, I probably saw bits of episodes and bits of programs, but no sooner had I seen one or two than I was away at sea again, so the whole thing was a complete mystery to me. But I actually watched a few of the programs just a few months ago, because they came back on the television, and I was actually quite shocked, because the characters are, they're well acted, but they're awful people, and people, the actors actually, like J.R. Ewing and all the rest of it, they played them extremely well. And I think that it was so appreciated by people is that because they actually identified with these people. And it was actually quite shocking to see that there were such scumbags in the world, and people truly identified with them, so much so that they loved the program. It was a real eye-opener to me. Very, very realistic. I can understand why people then took to Dallas and why they loved it, because it was so realistic to the daily lives that we live today and the people that you meet and have to work with.
It's kind of creepy, though, isn't it?
It's disturbing.
Well, I don't know about you, but I'm starting to wonder about evolution. I'm starting to think it's more like devolution. Like, things don't get better, they just get freaking worse.
I would agree with you. I don't think, I think we're still, the mentality of people today and our world leaders and everything that's going on is as medieval as it could be. I think if you turn the clock back 500, 800 years to England and France and Germany, you'd find exactly the same people doing exactly the same things. We do it faster, we do it quicker, we have better weapons and all the rest of it. But the reality is our society is just as medieval, just as vicious, just as psychopathic as it was 500, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago. We haven't actually changed or learned anything in society, absolutely nothing.
Incidentally, we've still got a royal family. Several hundred years ago. And the working week used to be, I think there was some kind of study released about how many times you'd spend at work and that kind of thing. Apparently, yep. Back in the day, even during serfdom, you had to work less hours a week than we do today, and you've got higher quality produce that even the local lords and what have you would eat, you know?
Yeah.
It's almost like we're worse slaves today than we were back then. They've just convinced us that we're free.
Well, I think we are worse, because I think in the old days you would have the housewife, the farmer's wife at home preparing food and doing the washing and all the rest of it. And there would be the one worker in the house, the farmer, the father, and he would be off work. Well, now it's almost compulsory that we have both parents working and the children are put into some little crèche somewhere. So, you know, you don't even get the family spirit and the family communication that would have been so intense in those days. So not only are we working twice as hard, we're actually destroying our family units and our families left, right and centre. And I'm pretty sure that 500 years ago, teenagers didn't get blasted out of their brains on pot and dope and LSD, but they do now, because there is nothing left in their lives to look forward to. I think a lot of suicide cases, which are never discussed in this country, and if you actually talk to these people and find out why they committed suicide, it's basically a lack of self-esteem, lack of respect, but also a lack of, or a very good understanding of just what a rotten picture they're living. And they can't see their way out of it, so they kill themselves. Mm. And it's an absolute tragedy.
Yeah. Same with the prescription drug suicides. I think they've reached a record in the United States. Like, I think more deaths, yep. unnatural deaths in America caused by suicide than anything else.
Yeah, I would fully understand that. I travelled through the States with my wife a few years ago, and I was actually quite shocked. I went over there as a lifetime ambition to go and see America and see the things that I used to read about and dream about. And we did a 10-week tour. We did 24,000 kilometres. We visited about 34 states, I think. And did the usual things of visiting Niagara Falls, Death Valley, Yosemite National Park. We saw the Space Shuttle Atlantis take off. We went to Tombstone. We did all the usual sightseeing things, Grand Canyon. And I didn't go over there with any political intent at all, but halfway around the country, I became aware that there was something wrong with the country. It felt wrong. And we started talking to people, and they were only too pleased to talk to us. It was almost as though these people had never talked to anybody in their lives. And we were talking about New Zealand and the world, and we became aware of just how isolated their knowledge of the world is. But they genuinely seemed lost. And sometimes it was actually very difficult to get on with our journey, because these people wouldn't let us go. They wanted to keep on talking to us. And on our final day before we flew out, we were at a motel, and we were talking to a guy, and we were talking to him for about 3 hours. He was buying us whiskies and wines all evening. And at the end of it, it was late in the evening. He finally stood up and he said, look, Ian, he says, I've got to go, but I just want to thank you. He says, that's the best conversation I've had in 5 years. And I thought, well, how lovely was that, but also how tragic. Because if I'm a visitor to his country and I'm the only thing that he's talked to for 5 years, there's something very wrong with the country.
It's like fear, or, you know what it is? Constant freaking distraction. the least educated, the most well-entertained population on Earth.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. They are absolutely focused on television. If you go to a Best Western, you go into the breakfast room in the morning and there's two or three televisions all hanging from the ceiling and all that. And nobody's talking to each other. They're all focused on these drama people on television who pretend to be newsreaders. And all these people are just staring with just totally blank faces at these television screens. And there's no conversation going on, absolutely nothing. If you actually say hello to some people that are early in the morning like that, they look actually quite shocked. It is actually quite terrible, which is why we kept away from all the cities. We drove around the backwoods, and unfortunately we had to go on a lot of freeways and all that, interstates, because it was the only way to get around the country in the time we had available. But we avoided the cities because it's just... apart from one place, we drove through a place called St. Joseph's, a city right in the Midwest there, on the borders of Kansas and Missouri, I think, I don't remember. And there was nothing there. There were tumbleweeds going down the streets. There were these beautiful, beautiful Victorian Georgian buildings with plywood in the windows. The place, I'd heard of ghost towns in America, but this was a ghost city. It was just dust and dead. And we filled up with petrol. We finally found a petrol station. We filled up with petrol, crossed the river, and went into Kansas. And we stopped at a place called Maryville that evening and got chatting to a couple who owned a farm outside Maryville, and they invited us down for a meal that evening. And once again, it was actually harder to get away from these people because it wasn't until about midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning that we could actually pull ourselves away from them because they just wouldn't stop talking. But I asked them about St. Joseph's. I said, you know, what's happened with that city? And the old man, he was about 75, 78, and he said, he says the corporations decided that the city wasn't worth it anymore, so they moved the big businesses out of it 100 or 200 miles, and the city has collapsed. And I believe that's the sort of thing that's going on all over the place. You know, places like Detroit, once the businesses have finished with it, they just move out and they collapse. Everything just collapses.
Something tells me there's somebody making a lot of money on the back burner with these kind of deals, you know? Imagine you can just destroy the real estate of a city and then come in and buy that puppy up for pennies on the dollar.
Yeah, it's a few years. It has to be a few years later, you know, when everything just goes downhill and people move out, then the land, you buy the land up for nothing and then build your city back up again and make vast profits out of it. But the human catastrophe of the families and the communities that are destroyed is absolutely incredible. And it really, and this is what I was saying about driving around America at the time, is that you just got this feeling that something was desperately wrong with the country. And this is what we saw. And by the time we had done 8 weeks, you know, it was apparent that it wasn't just one state or one area. This was right across America. If we had just gone to, say, Kansas or Missouri or Tennessee and seen it, you know, because people could have said, oh, well, you know, you didn't do enough traveling because it wouldn't have been like that somewhere else. Well, it actually was like that, and it was like that everywhere. The only area of the United States that we didn't travel to, and we basically, because we ran out of time, was the northeastern corner, the Jersey, New Hampshire, Washington, New York. So most of the states are missing on our list were over in that corner because we just didn't have enough time. And it was my thought that, okay, we can easily lop off that little area and come back another time and just spend 6-7 weeks in that one area. And so we did the rest of America. And the rest of America is really going through some hard times.
Had you been to America before and come back and seen a difference, or had this?
Oh, for sure. When I went to sea for the first time, I joined a few ships, one in New Orleans, one in Houston, and I'd flown through the airports before, and the America that I knew back in the 1970s was exactly the sort of America that you would have seen with John Wayne and all the Hollywood stars of the 50s, 60s and 70s. It was exactly what they portrayed it to be. And the food was fantastic, and the orange juice, you know, just bled out of water coolers everywhere. And
the breakfasts were so large you couldn't eat them and that sort of thing. And I told my wife Raymond, I said, look, you know, when we get over there, we're going to find out, you're going to find all this fantastic food and all the rest of it. Well, the food was just awful. The change in America from the 1970s, early 80s, is almost indescribable. It is a country that has fallen apart. It's disintegrated. There were sometimes we had meals there in some of these motels. I wouldn't have fed them to a dog. The food was just absolutely terrible. And that was, again, it was something that we noticed right across America. If you wanted a really good meal, or you wanted a meal that you could eat, you actually had to go to an expensive restaurant. But down at the grassroots level, it was, Denny's and McDonald's and even KFC. We went to Kentucky and went to the Mammoth Caves there. And there was a KFC place there, and we thought, come on, you know, we'll have to have KFC in Kentucky. And it was awful. I couldn't believe just how awful it was. It was just something you had to go there and experience to actually understand it. It's not something you can explain easily to people. You have to go there and experience it and realize just how bad it is.
Yeah, like Iraq.
Yeah. I've never been to Iraq and I've never been to Afghanistan, but I've talked to people here in New Zealand who have been to Iraq and Afghanistan, and they come back and they say the Iraqis and the Afghan people are wonderful people. The problems that they have over there have been caused by Western influence and everything else. If they had only just been left alone, you know, granted they had certain problems, you know, with Saddam Hussein and all this, but the countries, the people are good people. But the politics that come along and destroy these things is quite revealing. And it's the same all over the world, of course. Some of the countries we've been to, and I've been to quite a few countries. The people, I have never been to a country yet that I haven't liked the people. But when you get up to the political systems and the legal systems, you realize just where all the troubles are, and the very rich, very wealthy people that control everything and destroy so much. It's unbelievable.
Well, they don't really have anything, no responsibilities. Is that about the size of it? Because I've had a look all my life at people in power, people with riches and things of this nature, and it doesn't matter whether they're a great person or a wonderfully kind person, there's always something bad about them that surfaces, you know?
And you wonder,
how is it that people can't get into power and influence, like real power and influence, long-lasting power and influence, without being bought off and corrupted in some way, shape or form, or blackmailed in order to do the wrong thing?
I think it's a good question, and I have thought about it a few times, and I haven't thought about it too in-depth into that. But you often see good people going into politics, and within a few years they get destroyed. I think a system is just so immovable. To give you an example here, in 2006, I came across a problem in the legal system here in New Plymouth. And it wasn't my problem, so I couldn't really interfere with it. But after about a year, I could no longer stand back and watch this person getting ripped off. So I started to ask questions, and I started to get myself involved in it. And the funny thing was that I started talking to the solicitors and the lawyers involved, and I found that I wasn't able to communicate with them. So my first reaction was, okay, these are highly intelligent, you know, highly educated people who deal in law. I mean, the fundamental rock bottom foundation of society is law and rules governing our society. So these people are at the very heart of our society and our communities. So I thought, well, they're educated people, so it must be me. It has to be me. So I began to think, okay, well, why am I not communicating with these people? What am I not understanding? So I started doing a bit of reading, and I got hold of a book by a professor of law at Canterbury University called Duncan Webb. And I read this book. And at the end of it, well, to be absolutely frank, after every chapter or two, I actually had to put the book down and go outside into the garden and sit amongst the roses to stop myself from being physically sick. Because the book was quite revealing. It actually revealed the very mindset of these people. They are very, very sick, uneducated, intellectually retarded people. And then it all came clear to me why I couldn't talk to these people, because they actually didn't understand what I was saying. And that was a huge revelation. To actually sit in the room with a lawyer and a solicitor and realize, when you look into these people's eyes, that they actually don't understand what you're saying. And these people are so superior and so conceited, so powerful in their knowledge that they can control people and abuse people, that if you actually try and talk to them at the level of humanity and common decency and ethics, they don't understand it. And this is where I think the problem lies, because it is such an awful system that if you go into it and try and change it, you end up killing yourself. And so you get out. And traveling around the country, because I wrote a book about it, and I self-published it and started distributing it all around the country, and I sent out about 700 copies around the country, I had an awful lot of people come to me when I was selling my book, Stone to Dacon, and telling me of their experiences with lawyers and solicitors around the country. And they all faced exactly the same problem. They couldn't talk to these people. They simply didn't understand what they were saying. But I also came across lawyers and solicitors who told me quite frankly and quite outright that they had once been a lawyer and a solicitor, but they could no longer stand the system, and so they resigned and got out. And this is what happens, and it happens in politics. You get these people that go in with the best of intentions, and they're reasonably educated, but they go in there and they're up against a system so solid and so filthy that it actually destroys their will to continue the fight. And you have to be very, very hard-skinned to survive in that world of insanity, because this is how these people live. They simply cannot see what they're doing is wrong. They believe in it so much. And they reinforce their beliefs by talking to people of similar ilk. So in their whole lives, from the times that they leave school, from kindergarten onwards, these people are indoctrinated. It's rammed into them. And because they live in a world where they're surrounded by like people, they simply do not understand that there is another world, a different world, and it's a better world. So they continue doing what they're doing, and they reinforce each other left, right, and center. It is an amazing thing. And to give you a clear example of the power of that is that even though I wrote this book and sent it all around the country, not a single lawyer has contacted me over it. No solicitor, no lawyer. They can't do it. They do not know how to talk. So this is what you're up against. In trying to change a system that is so corrupt and so filthy, you first have to be able to communicate with these people, and that's just simply not possible. They don't understand.
They don't have humanity.
No, there's no humanity there at all. They are vacuums. They are absolutely inert.
Yeah, they do. They've sold humanity for a huge amount of money.
Correct. It's all about money. I worked it out. I thought, you know how many lawyers and solicitors there are in this country? There's, I thought it was over 10,000. It's actually, the last figure I saw was over 11,000. So if you work it out, then each one of these lawyers and solicitors must make, per annum, individually, at least $100,000. That means that the income to the New Zealand Law Society per year is over $1 billion. That's how much money comes out of society to do with law and the manipulation of law. And that's a minimum figure. It has to be a lot higher. Mm. And of course,
I notice how you put the extra qualifier and the manipulation of law, because ultimately the application is virtually the manipulation in and of itself nowadays.
Oh, absolutely. That's what the law is about these days. It has nothing to do with justice. They never talk about justice. If you ever hear a judge talking about the law in the courts, then all judges always explain to the applicants and the criminals that this is a court of law. They never say it's a court of justice. It's a court of law. So whenever some nasty little decisions are being made, it's all done because of the law, not because of justice. But when you go to the justice minister, he's not a law minister. They call him a justice minister because it gives the illusion that he's there to provide justice. And he's not. The justice minister is basically a waste of time. I approached one justice minister once to try and solve this problem that I had, and he was unable to do a thing. He had absolutely no responsibility towards justice or the law in this country whatsoever. The entire thing is an illusion. So, and I found this right from the very bottom right to the very top. There is nobody responsible for justice in this country. You get one or two people who are responsible for law, and the law, of course, can be manipulated to suit the system. And it's worth an incredible amount of money, absolutely vast amount of money. And the government, of course, you know, for every dollar the lawyers make, the government will take almost 50% of it in tax. So to go to the government and say, you know, you need to have justice here is a waste of time, because if they have justice in this country, the income that the government gets out of the law society would be halved. So the government is never going to do anything about justice in this country. It's worth far too much money. So,
think about it. I mean, how many times has a mafia don or something like that gone, you know what? Heroin's too profitable. Let's sell weed instead.
Yeah, that's right. You know, it's where the money is. Like, I can't remember if it was the Godfather or I can't remember at all now, but I remember seeing a documentary or program or a film to do with the mafia. And they had a kind of code of honor that they used to have, if you could have a code of honor in the criminal organization. But they never dealt with drugs. And then in the United States, drugs were introduced. And they realized that the profits to be had with drugs were so huge that they actually couldn't ignore it. So apart from the usual extortion and rape and murder and prostitution and all the rest of it, they then went to drugs. But apparently there were quite a number of the old mafia people who initially said, no, they won't touch it. It's against morality and ethics and humanity to destroy people with drugs. But again, the profits were just so massive that they were squeezed out, and the arsehole took over, and then you've got drugs everywhere. And in the old days, it was just the alcohol and the tobacco. And the tobacco was never a big problem until they started introducing cigarettes at the beginning of the last century. And the alcohol has always been controlled by society and communities and people. But nobody can control drugs. And so the drugs are the most profitable and the most destructive thing that are around. And it's all done because...
I'm not sure if nobody can control drugs. The CIA seems to be doing a fine job.
In what way?
In growing and distributing
it. Oh, they're doing a fantastic job. Yeah,
it was a record it was a record last quarter, you know.
Yeah, this is one of the things. Well, you see, this is one of the things that nobody ever really... This is one of the things that I can never understand on the news media. They give you all the information about what America is doing, what the CIA is doing, what the military is doing, and all the rest of it, but nobody ever does anything about it, you know. And they said that the Taliban were knocking out the drugs in Afghanistan, and they were doing a very good job on it. And then, of course, the Americans went in, and of course, they had a record year for producing drugs then, because that's what the Americans are allowing to happen. But that's the problem all over the world, and it's a corporate thing. It's because people don't naturally gravitate to drugs and alcohol and all the rest of it. This is forced upon them by the system.
Oh, but then again, drugs have been used in many, many cultures throughout time for a long period of time. I think it's one of the oldest traditions ever.
Well, the original thing would have been drugs to alleviate pain and all the rest of it. I mean, the opium thing... was a British-sponsored catastrophe in China. The Chinese didn't have opium until the British introduced it into China. And again, the profits were astronomical. So, and the Chinese, actually, the Chinese government, whoever was in charge at the time, they tried extremely hard to stop it happening. But then the British came in with their gunboats and their soldiers and started shooting people, and eventually they overturned the local law, and opium was then flooded into China. And of course, this is the perception that we have now, is of the Chinese sucking on these opium pipes. But that was never part of their culture. That was forced onto them by the British. who quite conveniently don't want to talk about that anymore. But this is, and again, it's the same thing with the heroin and the cannabis and all the rest of it. People in South America, when they were using the drug, but they were using it as part of a local thing that they understood. They knew how to use it, they knew the problems with it, and they didn't abuse it like it's being done today, because the drugs today are recreational drugs. Drugs in the past were never recreational, but now they've been called a recreational drug. It's just another way of covering up how nice and good they are. Mm.
Also to say that all the other drugs that they're giving you are medicinal, when in actual fact most of them are probably 10 times more likely to kill you than any illicit drug.
Well, that's it, and there's no trust and faith in it anymore, and you know, you've got to be really careful now about what's being touted out there. In the past, you know, if they said they had a drug that would help combat TB and all this, the penicillin and all these sort of things, this is exactly what they were. They were drugs that actually helped you survive and kick out these drugs. But now there's so much on the market, and they're there for profit. They're not there for your good and your the benefit of mankind.
If they cured you, they put themselves out of business. So here's a question, economically, are they going to try and cure you? Really? Really? Is the doctor actually going to give you the advice? Or is he going to take the perks that he's offered and take that trip to Tahiti that he's always been dreaming about?
Yeah, and this is the problem, is it? And it started off in the United States, of course, with doctors endorsing certain drugs because they were paid to do so. And people, you see, this is where the level of trust in the world has completely obliterated us, in that people in the past used to trust. You used to trust your doctors. You used to trust the World Health Organization. You used to trust the medical authorities in each country. But now each one of these places and each one of these authorities, they're all on the bandwagon now as well, you know, and we have all these flu vaccines that we're supposed to be taking to stop these epidemics. You know, 10 years ago, at the beginning of the new millennium, every single year we had a new pandemic flu that was going to wipe out the planet. You know, we had swine flu, we had bird flu, we had SARS, and every year it was a different one. And it was all panic and it was all fear, and everyone rushed out and bought all these drugs and these Panadols and everything else and Tamiflu. And of course, nobody really died. You know, no, the people that died would have probably died anyway, because that's the nature of the human race. You get diseases. Sometimes you fight them and win, and sometimes you don't. But all of a sudden, if it was all about buy this, buy that to combat this deadly thing that was going to kill everybody. Well, of course, we're still here today. You know, there's no epidemics, no pandemics, nothing. It's just it's all in the media, it's all in the politics, it's all in the media, and all in the corporations and the profits.
Yeah.
And people believe it. This is what gets me, is that people suck it up like a flipping great big vacuum cleaner. You know, they suck up all this shit and just fill themselves up with dirt, and you can't talk to people. I've tried it. I give up now. And if people want to go out and buy $500 worth of drugs to combat flu, as far as I'm concerned, they can do it. You know, there's a waste of time telling them, because they just won't listen. This is how much we've been conditioned in our world. We are programmed completely. It's unbelievable.
Been conditioned almost as much as our brains have been washed, you know what I'm saying? In the shampooing sense of the word.
Now, you're not going to tell me that the shampoo has been conditioning our brains, have you?
Well, in actual fact, some shampoos have been found to turn you into a zombie, you know?
You didn't read too many sci-fi books.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, where do you think the people who write the sci-fi books get their ideas from? Reality.
I believe you. I think, you know, when you go back to the 1960s and 70s with Star Trek and all that, all the writers of it, you know, they used to consult with NASA and astronomers and astrologers and all the rest of it, and everything that they did was based on actual research, because like I said earlier on, if you're writing a book or a play or anything like that, you have to have a high degree of credibility in it. So Star Trek, for all of its drama and everything, was actually based on research and the credibility of the science. So, you know, there's always a modicum of fact in everything that's going on, but we're living in a world now where fact and truth have been turned into dirty words, you know, and we have conspiracy theorists and all the rest of it. And now what you've got to do is mention a conspiracy and everybody switches off because they've been programmed to believe that what was true has now become a conspiracy. And so you labelled it as a conspiracy. So people, although they're hearing the truth, they don't realise it's the truth because they've already switched off to it because somebody else labelled it a conspiracy.
It's quite convenient, you know. You can win any argument.
You can win any argument. And I give up with a lot of people because you try and tell them some things and their eyes glaze over and they just don't want to go there, you know. They just don't want to think about it. They just can't. They've been brainwashed. It's a frightening thing, and this is what I found in America. It's an absolutely frightening thing, and this is why it's so easy to get into a conversation over there, and you can't leave because these people. I don't think a lot of Americans actually talk to each other. You know, they listen to the soap operas and they listen to Fox Television and CNN and George W. Bush and Barack Obama, and they just believe absolutely everything that's being told them. It's a tragedy. It's an absolute tragedy what's happening in America.
One does have to feel sorry for them to a degree, don't you? Or did they all just bring it on themselves?
I feel sorry for them. I feel desperately sorry for them because I grew up surrounded by Americans. When I was a kid, my father was in the Royal Air Force in England, and we went out to France in the early 60s when... NATO and the Americans and the British were still having bases over in France, and De Gaulle came along and he kicked everybody out, but I was over there at the time when we could be over there. We were stationed just outside Paris, and everywhere was Americans, absolutely everywhere. I mean, they were just overwhelming. We were on an American base and they're American people. We went to an American cinema, and they were generous to a fault, the Americans. Especially if you're a 5-year-old, 6-year-old kid, you know, they give you chocolate bars and boxes of popcorn and magazines, you know, and comic books and all the rest of it. You just get, and these are the sort of things in those days that you didn't normally see because you couldn't afford it, and the British didn't have it, and this sort of thing. So, the view of Americans at the time, you couldn't fault them. And I've always held that belief because as I grew older and I started reading about America in the Second World War and what the American soldiers did, what they had to put up with, and the generosity of American soldiers all around the world, the airmen and the Navy, you know, it was just absolutely, you simply couldn't fault them. And they were very erratic in which way they fired their guns. You know, there was an excellent chance that you might get shot by one of them yourself. But they apologised afterwards. But no, they were desperately good people. But I think they've been brainwashed. They've been programmed by television. Television over in America is the god. And if every single channel out of the hundreds of channels over there, if they're all talking the same shit, there is simply nobody left to talk to. And I think that's part of the big psychology of it. And that's the way they're controlled. They're just controlled because they don't know who to turn to. And if you've got 250-odd million people all being controlled like that, it's like I said with the lawyers, how do you go and talk to these people? Because you go and talk to them and they'll talk to you because you're an outsider, but they won't talk to each other because they don't know what to talk about. And they don't, you know, because... And of course, they have all their own individual problems over there, in that you have Republicans and you have the Democrats and you have the Jews and you have the Christians and you have the Hindus and the Muslims and the gays, you know, and everything becomes magnified over there. It's like looking at everything through a magnifying glass. You start off with a small problem and all of a sudden it's just overwhelming. And the media gets hold of it and blows it up and everybody becomes focused on it and nobody can think anymore. And everybody has to have an opinion because you're in a free country, so you're allowed to have your own opinion. And everybody's got a gun, so you're allowed to express your opinion. But the funny thing was that when I was over there, I never saw anybody with guns. I think I saw in the whole 10 weeks, we saw about 5 police cars right across America. It was unbelievable how few police cars there were. When I drove from Auckland to New Plymouth, when we came back, I saw 6 just in the drive back. But in the whole of the States, we only saw about 5 police cars. So, you know, they live in a world of illusions. And they don't know what the truth is anymore.
I guess the same is to a degree very true of us all. I mean, I get interviewed by Americans all the time, and vice versa. And some of the questions I get is, how's New Zealand? Is it different from what we're doing? And I say, well, take everything that's going on in your country right now, you know, the corrupt politicians, the financial scumbaggery, the progressive legislation to curtail your rights, the meaningless checkpoints, and the general New World Order type scumbaggery, and you just apply it over here, and they're like, oh, so you guys have got fluoride? Yeah, we've got fluoride. Oh, you guys have got toxic vaccines? Yeah, we've got toxic vaccines. Oh, you guys have got mercury-filled energy-saving light bulbs that you're trying to ban the alternatives to? Yeah, we've got that one. Yeah. Oh, you guys have got, like, progressive food legislation that's going to wind up making it illegal to basically grow your own veggies or collect rainwater or anything. Yeah, bro, absolutely.
Yep, I absolutely agree with you. I arrived in New Zealand in 1983, and this country now today is unrecognisable to what it was 30 years ago. It's changed completely. And we are following the American way, because our politicians, Helen Clark and John Key and Jim Bolger and Jenny Shipley, are all, they've got the American flag actually stamped on their hearts and their brains. And all of them are friendly with Americans. And so we follow the American policy. So, yes, there's no surprise to me that what's happening in this country with the genetically modified food, fluoridation, and the corporatization of absolutely every asset that New Zealand has is following the American dream. Well, New Zealand is no longer a country. It's no longer an identity. This country has a massive identity crisis, because people think they're in New Zealand, but they're actually following the corporate America. And we follow America, full stop, end of story. There's no argument anymore. And everything that we see, we watch American programs on television, American products that are pushed on us. Everything is American. And the law and the politics and the corporations and everything follows American ideals. And there's nothing, and New Zealanders accept it. This is why, of course, during Helen Clark's reign, 500,000 New Zealanders buggered off to Australia. And, I mean, it was an absolutely catastrophic flood of New Zealanders, but they were doing the right thing. They're going to a country where they can still talk, they can still think, they earn higher wages, the quality of life is much better. It's a tougher existence over there, of course, but people enjoy that. They enjoy working in a community where everybody pulls together and everybody talks to each other. And 500,000 New Zealanders, it's a flood, it's a biblical flood. And the government...
I was going to use the word exodus.
Well, it is, isn't it? It is. This is a country with just over 4 million people, and 500,000 New Zealanders in the space of 10 years left this country. And they're not coming back, and despite what John Key and all the rest of it are saying, these people are not coming back. You'll get a couple come back, you know, for family reasons or ties or whatever, but they ain't coming back, because, I mean, if 500,000 people came back, they'd all be unemployed. So there's nothing to come back for. And, you know, once the children start growing over there, they ain't going to come back to this funny country in New Zealand, you know, not when they've got the magnificent beaches and the sunshine and the entertainment and the jobs, the vast variety of jobs and careers that are available to them over there. But, of course, the government here just sits back and says, no, it's not a problem. And Helen Clark said, she even admitted, she was asked, you know, do you see there's a problem with all the young people just pouring over there? And she said, no, they're just a drain on the economy here, you know, send them over to Australia. So, you know, as a
Al-Qaeda... What she means is, we'll just pour in more immigrants.
Well, this is it. And you see, once you bring in the immigrants, you don't have to pay them as much. You can... they don't speak English too well. They can't fight the system. They don't get paid, you know, and what are they going to do? So, you know, the corporations take huge advantage of this. But they're just being brought over as slaves. They just don't realize it. But, you know, when you look at the countries that they're coming from, they're quite pleased to come over to a country like this where they can get the medical benefits and the education benefits for their children, which they couldn't get in their own country. But, of course, as they start to get older and they start to grow up and they start to learn and they speak English, they begin to realise that the white man down the road is actually being paid more than they are, and they're doing the same job. So up in Auckland, of course, they're having huge problems. I went up there 2 years ago, 3 years ago, with my wife when we were selling our books. And we went round to all the high schools in Auckland. And that was actually quite a revelation. Auckland's not a communal city or a community. It's actually a series of ghettos. You've got a Chinese ghetto, you've got an Indian ghetto, you've got a Maori ghetto, you've got an islander ghetto, you've got the rich whites ghettos, you've got the poor white ghettos, and it's not a community, it's not a city, it's a region of reservations where you import all these Chinese and Indians and Somalis and this, and you put them on the reservations. But they don't call them reservations, you know, they just, it's Auckland. It was actually quite...
Because in Auckland you don't need a reservation.
Have you been talking to Len Brown?
Well, actually, I did lead the Len Brown stand down protest.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that when you had that megaphone? Or?
Well, yeah. That's one of the times.